Hello, and welcome to the Jewish Heretics Podcast. This is the official podcast of the United Jewish People's Order and the Morrison Shevsky Center. We are a secular, progressive Canadian Jewish organization that's been around since the 1920s. My name is David Wall, and I am the community's cultural programmer, and I'll be your host for today. For this, the sixth episode of our podcast, I had the honor of speaking to members of the Toronto-based Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, a loose amalgam of like-minded organizations that came together in the wake of the Hamas attacks on southern Israel in October and the subsequent invasion of Gaza. I spoke to five community leaders, each with impressive activism credentials, about their motivations for joining the coalition, their connections to pro-Palestinian, anti-colonialist movements, and their understandings of various challenges faced by Jewish radical organizations in Canada. Rachel Small is the Canadian organizer for World Beyond War. We talked about some of the specifics of Canada's complicity in Israel's current actions in Gaza, as well as the origins of the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition.
So World Beyond War is a global organization to abolish war, abolish the whole military-industrial complex, and institute a just peace. We have chapters and members all over the world. And I myself am the Canada organizer with World Beyond War. So I am focused on working on what we can do here in so-called Canada to counter this country's ongoing, and I would say in some cases increasing, role as a warmonger, as a global arms dealer, as a weapons manufacturer, as a colonizer. And I'm one staff person with World Beyond War in Canada, but I am so privileged to work with organizers, activists, volunteers, and chapters and many members of our group all across the country who are just really all working together to end the violence of Canadian militarism in solidarity with those most impacted by it.
Actually, that's it's interesting because one of the things that keeps coming up is Canada's specific role in the current violence in Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about that? What kind of things that, you know, because it's a bit hidden. Everyone knows about the United States, but Canada flies under the radar a little bit. What kind of arms dealing goes on? How is Canada involved over there?
Yes. So we have been really focused on a Canada Stop Arming Israel campaign over the past few months. I mean, it's been ongoing for years, but of course, this has really come to the forefront in the past couple months as we've been witnessing just the carnage in Gaza, the slaughter of thousands of Palestinians. Front in our mind is, what are the ways that Canada is materially supporting this? So I think that one of the most relevant ways is that Canada does export, for example, in 2022, over $21 million dollars in military goods and services to Israel. At least 3 million of that is bombs, torpedoes, missiles, and other explosives. These numbers, though, I should say, are a vast undercounting of the actual weaponry and weapons parts that Canada sends to Israel, because it doesn't count the weapons that go through the United States on their way to Israel, which frankly is probably a majority of them. So these numbers are inadequate, but they still help to us to understand and to parse out the role that Canada is playing in not just arming, but profiteering off of the current violence. These companies that have offices and facilities in Canada, some of them are Canadian companies, some of them are global or American companies like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, that are just making a fortune off of the horrific loss of life right now. That's exactly what is happening. There are lots of other ways that Canada is deeply complicit in what's happening in Israel and Palestine and the Israeli military violence. Canada provides tons of diplomatic support in various ways to Israel. Canada also has a memorandum of understanding. It's called the Canada-Israel Strategic Partnership. We don't know all the details about it, but it within that, it commits Canada to military, police, intelligence, border security, and other types of public safety cooperation with Israeli counterparts. So there's a lot happening behind the scenes that Canada and the Canadian government is involved in that is directly supporting the violence that's happening. Not to mention all the UN votes where it's basically Canada, US and Israel voting against the rest of the world around any kind of justice for Palestinians.
Can we go back to October 7th and that terrible weekend? And what was the emotional reaction? And how soon were you spurred into action in support of the Palestinian people? Do you remember?
I remember initially quite a bit of confusion. The very first images I actually saw, maybe just where I happened to be online at that moment, were of a military checkpoint being demolished. And that was like the first image that I saw. And so my first reaction was, wow, let this wall fall. What an exciting moment. This was before I had heard anything about any people being killed. Very quickly, I heard more of the news and was hearing about a music festival and sort of all the other headlines that sort of quickly happened. I think that, I mean, World Beyond War as a war abolition organization, I think plays a really important role and has a really clear analysis that we don't support any war, any militarism, and that all loss of life is a problem. And we were immediately, I think, holding our breath, as I'm sure the rest of the world was too, for a really terrifying militarized response by the Israeli military. So I think that there was a real feeling of like, okay, it's unclear how many people in Israel have been killed today. And it's unclear, though seems certain, that many Palestinians are going to be killed very shortly as well. I come to this work as both a Jewish person and as an anti-war organizer. And as someone who's been a solidarity activist with many movements for justice around the world for decades, and I don't see these as conflicting perspectives. I see it as perspectives that help me learn to understand that people do things for different reasons, that different groups have their various traumas and then histories and things that inform their actions. And that there are ways that we can stand up, even if we're on the other side of the world, to stop horrific violence and loss of life that's happening somewhere else.
Can you talk about the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, how you became involved in, and why do you think it's important for Jewish organizations specifically, or Jewish people specifically, to stand up for Palestinians at this time?
For me, it's been really incredible to be part of the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, as a new grouping, but of organizations that have already existed and of people, very experienced organizers, and new people, new Jews in Toronto coming into movement building in this moment. It's been such a privilege to be part of it. I think what happened was that in October, it became obvious that there are many thousands of Jews in Toronto who were already seeing the way almost instantly our grief was being weaponized against Palestinians by the Israeli state, but also within Canada. And I think there was just this strong visceral need to say no and to reject that and to be able to stand up as Jewish people and stand against Israeli war crimes, and to call for a permanent ceasefire, to call for a halt to all Canadian military aid and arms sales to Israel, to demand an end to the occupation, to demand a just and lasting peace. These are demands that certainly other groups were making, but it suddenly became clear we had to do this together as Jews in this city right now. So as a few different Jewish organizations, and also as, for example, with World Beyond War, as Jewish members of allied organizations, we came together to see what we could do. And it's grown very organically. More and more people are constantly reaching out and saying that they want to get involved, that their Jewish community also feels that it's so important to reject this false dichotomy between caring about Palestinians and caring about Jews, or caring about the loss of Israeli lives as well as Palestinian lives. And that instead we understand that the lives and fates of Palestinians and Israelis are intertwined, as are our struggles as Jews and Palestinians here in Toronto.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It extends to Toronto as well, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, to me, fighting anti-Semitism, fighting anti-Palestinian racism, fighting Islamophobia, these are all part of the same fight. I mean, this is something that many of us have been involved with for many years. And it's been so clear over the past decade that the forces that really endanger Jews here in Toronto are fascism, are white supremacy, are the same, frankly, terrifying growth of extreme movements that also put racialized folks, Muslim folks, and Palestinians at risk in this city, and is deeply connected to the homophobic and transphobic violence that has been on the rise as well. And it's so empowering to realize that we're allies together in this struggle. This is not taking away from the idea of fighting anti-Semitism, as I know some people like to present it. To me, it's like, okay, now we can have a really powerful coalition to fight this together. Over the past couple weeks, the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition has played an important role in pushing back on the violent state, not just narrative, but active criminalization of peace activists under the banner of anti-Semitic hate crimes. Here in Toronto, 11 peace activists who are now being called the Peace 11 have been criminalized and are facing very serious charges for allegedly putting up posters and washable red paint on the side of an Indigo building in Toronto to highlight CEO Heather Reisman's role in providing direct financial support for Canadian citizens to join the Israeli military. Her providing that financial support is not up for debate. It's a clear statement of fact. She is the founder of the Hesed Foundation for Lone Soldiers, and her public contributions to it, millions of dollars, is public information. But the state right now is trying to give the impression that posters that state that information are in fact an anti-Semitic hate crime. So this has been a key place for the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition to make it absolutely clear that criticism of the state of Israel is not anti-Semitism. Criticizing those who support the Israeli military's war crimes is not anti-Semitism, and that we refuse to be silenced, and we will continue to defend those who are being criminalized, intimidated, etc., for speaking out to condemn the genocidal actions of Israel. And we really see the recent, very aggressive arrest of these 11 peace activists. Their homes were literally raided in the middle of the night by 8 to 10 police each. Their doors were broken down. They were handcuffed in their beds. Like, these are very aggressive police actions. And we see these as a clear effort by police to target and repress Palestine solidarity, even as a majority of people in Canada are calling for a ceasefire. So we, as Jews, are speaking up and saying, not only will we not be silent as a genocide rages on in our name, but we will stand with the peace activists who are taking a stance on this. And I also want to say that there have been really strong presence of Jews, both individually and in powerful contingents with 40-foot banners at a lot of the incredible actions that have happened in Toronto over the past couple months. There's been Jewish contingents at weapons blockades, where a couple hundred folks in Toronto repeatedly have blocked all entrances to weapons factories in the GTA. These are companies that do support the Israeli military and send weapons. There have been really powerful Jewish contingents taking space and refusing to be silent at sit-ins at Scotiabank, for example, which is the largest foreign funder of Israel's biggest weapons company, Elbit. I'm seeing Jews stepping up in just an incredible way across the city and frankly across the country. And I don't think that the more mainstream Jewish lobby is going to be able to recover from this. And I don't think they're going to be able to keep saying all Jews in Canada stand with Israel, or oh, we speak for the Jewish community in Canada. I think we've made it clear that that's frankly not true.
I spoke to Vlada Biliak of If Not Now, an anti-occupation organization with international reach, about the nature of grief and how it informs the coalition's activism.
So I organize with If Not Now Toronto. We are we are the Toronto chapter, and I believe only Canadian chapter of the If Not Now movement, which began in the States and is a movement of Jews working to transform our Jewish community's support for the Israeli occupation. If Not Now in the States was born in 2014 out of Operation Protective Edge. And it's been chugging along since, both fortunately and unfortunately, due to circumstances. And the Canadian chapter, our Toronto chapter, came about in 2017. I was part of the very first training cohort here in Toronto, and have been involved, on and off since. And as I'm sure you're aware, right now, in If Not Now terms, we refer to this as a moment of the whirlwind, which is a moment of sort of intense escalation that results in a lot of people becoming engaged in the struggle and wanting to get involved. So there is a lot of work for Jewish groups and any Palestine solidarity groups like ours to be doing to plug people into the movement.
I'm wondering if you could go back to the horrible weekend of October 7th and when the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition came together. Mm-hmm. What's your recollection of that, and how did you become involved in the coalition and representing If Not Now?
Yeah, so that first week after October 7th, I was completely numb. I was so deep in a well of grief and pain that I was just seated on my couch, like couldn't move. Mm. A week in, I saw a tweet that really shook me out of that state. And I was like, oh, we gotta organize, we gotta move. And I messaged, I texted one-on-one every single member of If Not Now, and then started emailing every other sort of peripheral listserv that I was on, asking people if they wanted to get together for a meeting and organize something together. And two of the people that I emailed me back and said, hey, there is a Jewish coalition meeting tonight. Do you want to be a part of it? And I said, 100%. And so, and those two people were Molly and Shale. They invited me to that very first, what ended up becoming the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition meeting. And I was in a Zoom room with both people that I know and love very dearly, and people who were very new to me, both absolutely new to me, we'd never met, and new to me in an organizing context.
Right. Can we just go back to what you said about your kind of stupor of grief, which is, of course, something we hear about in relation to the weekend of October 7th and what was going on and the ramifications of that in terms of the experience in Gaza. This grief, how does it play into your activism around Gaza and around Israel in general? And how do you hold grief for what I assume are Israeli victims of the Hamas attack and grief for Gazans at the same time as a Jewish person, as an activist?
Yeah, I think that piece is why organizing with If Not Now is so important to me, because it's something that the group takes very, very seriously. And that is just an intense commitment to justice, freedom, and equality for all Israelis and Palestinians. Mm. And I think that that I think about. I know that you asked me to talk personally, and I'm kind of going to talk about if not now, but it is because those are so many of my own personal feelings. I think of if not now as one part of an ecosystem of organizing around Palestinian solidarity, and also within an ecosystem of Jewish organizing around this specifically. And I think in the States it's a little bit more obvious because there are so many leftist Jewish organizations in the States doing this kind of work, and in Canada there aren't as many. I really think that there are a lot of Jews out there right now who are really struggling to hold both, or maybe not struggling to hold both, but struggling to see that complexity and that holding both truths in the organizing that's happening in the world. And so when I think about, that's why I think it's really important to be acknowledging that complexity in the work that we do, both because it's honest and true and shows a moral clarity, and because there are people who want to get involved, who want to know that grief is going to be held and they're not going to be alone in it, and they don't have to deny it to do the really powerful and important work that we are doing right now. And ultimately, I think that it is such a failure for us on the left if we choose not to hold that grief and not to hold that that deep desire for that freedom and justice for all. It is a failure if we choose not to hold that and give it all to our mainstream Jewish institutions who are saying grief, pain, trauma, that the Jews are feeling right now, welcome in. We accept it. You are so welcome to bring those feelings here. We have them too. Yeah, we really risk losing a lot of people when we turn away from that pain and say, it's not important right now. We just have to focus on this. So I think for me and my work through If Not Now, holding that complexity is so vital.
Is it important to talk to people who are much more Zionist and much more conservative and much more fearful in the Jewish community? Is it important to talk to people like that? Or do we just, in terms of almost self-care, do we avoid that?
Yeah, David, that's such an important question. In If Not Now, we talk about spectrum of support. I mean, people talk about spectrums of support in a lot of organizing. People who are messaging If Not Now daily are in our DMs, are commenting on our posts, are doxing our members, telling us that we're self-hating, telling us, threatening us, saying horrible things about how we will be judged by Hashem for our actions and how our families must be fit, all of this stuff. Those people are our active opponents. And that's not our audience, and it's not our target, and those aren't our people. So it's so painful. But I think our target is really the people who are feeling very confused and lost and disillusioned right now, and are not sure what to do, and are seeing their Hillels and their shuls and their families and their friends and their summer camp community and their schools and whatever, saying horrifying things about Palestinians and what's happening in Gaza, and are seeing a lot of people that they that politically they might feel maybe confused or unfamiliar with, saying truthful things about what's going on in Gaza and what's happening in Israel-Palestine more broadly, and have no idea what to do about that, are really waking up to this maybe for the first time or taking tiny baby steps. Those are the people we want to be speaking to, and we want to bring them along with us into this struggle. Mm. And as for that, those active opponents or even more passive opponents who are not with us at all, I think there it's kind of a long game. It's a game of polarization, and it's kind of a long game. The polarization piece, I think, is much more true with Jewish institutions who, in moments like these, they really show just how much they have left behind their own constituents, their own congregation members, how out of touch they are with younger generations who are very aware of what's going on and are loudly saying not in our name. And with the individual people, I mean, like I said, I've been a part of If Not Now since 2017. I have identified as an anti-Zionist for much longer than that. And as I'm sure you can relate to, have lost a lot of friends and acquaintances, and have family members in Israel who will not speak to me anymore. And also, just in these last 2 months, have had people that I haven't spoken to in decades, people I went to high school with, DMing me saying, "Hey, I'm really confused about this, and I don't know who else to go to. So I thought I would ask you if that's okay. But what are you thinking about this? Or how are you reconciling this? Or I heard about this on the news, and I don't even know what to believe anymore." So that's what I mean when I talk about the long game. I think sometimes they end up coming around.
Molly Kraft, a union organizer for the Ontario Nurses Association, is a key member of the Toronto chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice. We discussed some of the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition's organizing and actions carried out so far in solidarity with Gaza since October 7. Can you talk briefly about Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a fantastic acronym, SURGE. Talk about the organization, a bit of its history, and also your relationship with it.
Yeah, for sure. So it originated in the States, and it was in response to a massive, massive growth in white supremacist organizing and the kind of long-standing call from Black, Indigenous, and people of color-led movements to, quote, organize your people. So meaning white folks, get into your communities and organize. And the nice connection actually to Jewishness for me is that I had been a longtime activist in, you know, anti-Zionist pro-Palestinian spaces from a Jewish perspective, trying to cultivate Jewish community around it. But part of what I started to notice is that without grappling with whiteness and without looking at where Jews had been invited into whiteness, Ashkenazi Jews in North America, that I would never really be able to organize on these issues. And so myself and a number of other founding members of SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice Toronto, are actually Ashkenazi Jews with a really deep investment in bringing that vision of, quote, organize your people into Jewish community. So the foundation of SURGE in Toronto was longtime activists getting together and saying, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can bring this to Canada and we can make it unique to our own fights. And so what we do is try to organize more white people to actively undermine oppressive systems in all forms. And to me, that's really connected to fighting anti-Semitism, fighting for a free Palestine, all that kind of stuff.
Can you talk about the creation of the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition, how it happened, and actions that have taken place since. How has the collaboration played out?
Yeah, so it feels really beautiful and apt to say that our dear Amy Gottlieb, who is like a longtime anti-Zionist, queer, you know, everything activist, every struggle, she's been on the front lines. And unfortunately, we lost her this summer. She had cancer, and a number of us in her, what we call chosen family, were together over these weeks in the summer. And it just so happened that her beautiful memorial was right after October 7th, maybe a couple days. And so many of the Jewish folks in the room are anti-Zionist, and but deeply invested in continuing to grow Jewish community, inviting new people in, inviting questioning people in, you know, taking action, continuing to build. And a couple people just turned to each other and said, we need to have a meeting. And so we sent out a note pretty much to anyone we could think of that was ready to take that position, whether it was explicitly anti-Zionist or not. And I think that's really important, because I don't think that this conversation needs to exclude folks who are just exploring, like, I haven't been ready to say certain things, but this moment feels too big not to. And so that first initial meeting was a group, and we just got together and said, we must have a Jewish presence to interrupt the narrative that Jewish safety rests on the oppression of another people. Like, we cannot have that happen. And so we planned our first action, and it was beautiful. And our goal was simply to bring out as many Jewish people as possible to say, this violence will not happen in our names. We are deeply committed to the liberation of Palestine, as well as fighting anti-Semitism. And those things are not, you know, Jewish safety is not in opposition to Palestinian safety. And that action, I think we got, you know, a few hundred people, maybe even 500 people out to the corner of Yonge and Bloor, and we shut down the intersection for an hour. And once we did that, I think it became clear to us that there was a bigger role to play for Jews Say No to Genocide. And the name came from, we had been so inspired by, in the United States, JVP and other organizations saying, Jews say ceasefire now. But to us, in the Canadian context, we felt like ceasefire is the beginning, but ending the genocide and the occupation is really the goal. And so we call ourselves Jews Say No to Genocide. And since then, we've been organizing pretty much an action a week, which is a little bit maybe too much, but we do feel the need for Jews to take a really strong position as our trauma and our religion and our culture is being used to inflict violence on Palestinians. We generally have a much more conservative and limited Jewish community in terms of the vastness of positions that are acceptable. And what I mean by that is that in the States, there are, you know, whole synagogues and institutions that are leftist and more openly in support of a free Palestine. And it's not as wild to imagine that that's in a sort of normative space in Jewish community. In Toronto, we literally only have, you know, United Jewish People's Order. We have I don't think any synagogues that would say that they support a free Palestine, which is pretty like devastating and heart-wrenching. And so I think that in the Canadian context, A, there's a massive need for Jews who identify with Jewishness, whether it's culture, religion, or otherwise, and who want to be together in that loving space of saying, we are Jews organizing for this. So that's the first thing. There's that vacuum. And then B, I think that specifically to Canada, we have a government that really touts like a line of peace and, you know, multiculturalism and mass acceptance at the same time as overt criminalization of Palestinian perspectives. So, you know, telling Palestinians they can't say things like they are Palestinian if they're a professor, or, you know, people getting investigated at work for posting really, really basic support of Palestinian life. So we have an intense kind of like hypocrisy of Canadian perspectives on multiculturalism and then how people are actually treated. And then on top of that, we also have a massive support of the Canadian government behind the scenes in a number of different ways. selling arms to Israel that are actively used to destroy Palestinian people and their communities. And then funding through our own tax dollars. You know, like there are many organizations, Zionist organizations in Canada that are allowed to collect tax dollar money through charitable donation receipts and then use that, for example, the establishment of Canada Park, which is on top of a previous Palestinian settlement. So we really have blood on our hands as Canadians. And I think that Jews Say No to Genocide takes all of that and says, we have our unique way of seeing this here in Canada. There's more of a need for a Jewish voice because it's not institutionally present. And there's more of a need for education for not just Jewish Canadians, but for every Canadian about what our government is actually funding. And there's like an amazing article that is called The Architect for Apartheid that I can send and link. But like it basically says that Canada is the architect for apartheid, meaning our Canadian government and our settler colonial state really is something that Israel mirrors and wants to like participate in and wants to echo and believe in. And so I think as Canadians, we have a unique position to say that also can't happen in our names.
I asked Gerd Sabar, an expert on entrepreneurial brand building, company reputation fixing, and a media advisor for Independent Jewish Voices, about challenges faced by Palestinian activists and their allies in the Canadian media landscape.
Independent Jewish Voices is one of the handful of pro-Palestinian organizations, Jewish organizations in the city. And before this all broke out, we were doing just a lot of I was doing a lot of work with a national organization on helping them launch their Together Against Apartheid campaign, which we launched about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago.
So one thing that I've noticed, and it's pretty obvious because it's very much part of the history of Palestinian and Palestinian allied activism, is that there's these amazing events and all of this amazing activism is it just does not get the attention in mainstream media. And I'm thinking recently of the huge event that happened in Ottawa with, I don't know how many people were there, 100,000 or some huge, vast numbers were there to protest the invasion of Gaza and Canada's role. And it was underrepresented in the media, if represented at all. It kind of was this blip that went by. And you see that across the board. So as a person who's well-versed in public relations and media and strategizing around that stuff, how do you break through? How does an organization, for example, like Independent Jewish Voices, break through into the media, mainstream media sphere, which is, although not, do or die in terms of Palestinian activism, but it certainly helps to have attention. How do you go about doing that? And is it possible?
For me personally, learning as a recent transplant to Canada and learning the Canadian media market, it's been a really interesting learning curve to see how strong of a hold mainstream Jewish narrative has on the media market here. And so to your point, the challenge is real. To have a protest the size as the one that happened in Ottawa and have it be barely a blip is pretty, pretty freaking crazy. What's interesting is that the media cycle and the timing of that Ottawa protest, was just a week or two, a couple weeks ago. We're already in, I would say, phase two of kind of media attention around this issue. Phase one was when October 7th happened, and there were cameras after cameras after reporter after reporter at each of the rallies. Getting media attention was not hard, but we're now have reached this next phase, and it's and we see it happen all the time, which is it's a bit of a it's this curve, and once attention, once the media has told a story a certain amount of times, And once, once you know, they have the beast has a constant drive for new news, right? And so the challenge becomes creating that filter is what is your new news that you're bringing to the table? There's only so many times that the media is willing to cover rallies over and over again, week after week. And that compounded with the, again, with the stronghold that mainstream Jewish media narrative has, and without getting too tropey about, you know, what the powers that lie underneath the media that are pulling whatever strings possible to shape the narrative in a certain direction, that's a real issue that absolutely exists, right? That's been studied. There was a recent report that was released about CTV and their basically the rules they've put in place around covering Palestinian news, their refusal to say the word Palestinians, their the stories that weren't put on air. There's just a lot of systemic challenges that Palestinians face in getting their stories across. And so even though we're seeing, I think, a massive shift on the ground across the world, it's the grassroots versus the grass tops, and the grass tops haven't yet fully caught up to what's happening at the grassroots, and they're holding on white dominant supremacist infrastructure is holding on to its powers and preventing a lot of these stories from breaking through in a meaningful way. That said, there are things that we are talking about in terms of how to make stories more likely to break through nowadays. And the requirement is that filter of what are you doing that's new? What are you doing that's new and newsworthy, be it in the way you plan an action, be it in the way, the speakers you have, be it in the way you present yourself. How are you doing it that's different and that would actually pique the media's interest?
That all makes sense. It's interesting that there was a fair amount of media attention when the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition sort of took over Union Station a couple of times. So the question is it newsworthy enough to have a bunch of Jews doing that? Like, is the Jewish solidarity of the coalition, like, is that as big a deal as I think it is? Because one thing about the Ottawa demonstration was that it was put on by Palestinians. You know, Palestinian youth movement, there were Jews there, but that wasn't the focus. So I'm wondering if that's one of the things that we can, as Jewish people, really help with, is that allyship.
Absolutely. I think the allyship is critical. I think the fact that, Jewish-led activities, I do think for the same reasons that the stories of Palestinians get oppressed, those doors are more open to Jews than they are to Palestinians. And that's a painful reality of the world in which we're living in. And so not only can and should we continue leading actions on behalf of our Palestinian brothers and sisters, but the burden is not the right word. The obligation and the responsibility is absolutely on us to do so, because we hold a key that the Palestinians don't have access to. And so we absolutely need to be using it over and over and over again, every which possible way, to ensure that the Palestinian voice gets heard, that Palestinian story gets told.
Corinne Silverwoman, a longtime member of the United Jewish People's Order Winchevsky Community, is a Toronto-based therapist specializing in trauma-informed anti-oppressive practice. I asked her about some of the emotional complexities of the current struggle.
So I'm actually a graduate of the Winchevsky School. So I went there when I was a kid, and I had my B'nai Mitzvah there. And now I have two kids, and my kids go to Winchevsky School. So there's a multi-generational feel for me, carrying on the values of secular Judaism, the values of social justice that my parents and my grandparents instilled in me. And it feels very full circle and moving to be able to send my kids to this school. Especially in this very heavy time, it feels so nourishing to have a community that is proudly Jewish and proudly taking a stand against genocide and against against war in our name. October 7th was a period for me that I was actually really surprised by myself. I've been an activist for Palestinian rights for 20 years. And on October 7th, I honestly felt like an epigenetic trigger within my body, a profound fear that was not intellectual, that was literally in my cells and my bones, not something I could even talk about. And that fear, that grief deserved love, deserved attention, deserved care. But we cannot stay there. We have to move through that. We have to see what's behind the grief. And so why it has been so profound for me to meet other activists, community members, and Jewish people that say not in our name is because we are all doing this from a place of grief. We all felt something on October 7th. But multiple truths can exist at once. If you're only holding the one truth of October 7th and not holding the 75 years before that and what has happened since October 7th, then you're stuck. And how do we move through stuckness? We have to learn to hold multiple truths. I always say that we can hold priority and nuance at the same time. Mm. I don't think what's happening in Gaza is complex, but I do think there can be priority, nuance, and multiple feelings. Everything I'm doing in my activism right now comes from grief, because behind grief is anger. Behind anger is love. So many of our community right now are just stuck in grief, moving to fear. And we all know what fear does. Fear with miseducation plus racism plus colonial attitudes plus unmetabolized generational trauma is what is happening in Israel and Gaza right now. It must stop. We have to face our shadows in a deep, deep way while also stopping the violence, stopping the killing. Right now, my focus has been on a ceasefire because the killing and the violence has to stop. I do not want my children to live in a world. You know, my daughter said to me the other day, my 10-year-old, "Mama, you've been going to so many protests for Palestine. Is everything better now?" And it literally broke my heart because thousands and thousands of people have been taking to the streets. I went to Ottawa with my father, and according to the organizers for a ceasefire in Ottawa, there were 50 to 100,000 people there. And yet mainstream media did not report the protest at all. And so once there is a ceasefire, my activism is going to be more into facing my own community with talking to people that do not agree with me, talking to people that don't have the same opinions as me, talking to my own community that is only stuck in a place of grief. And yes, I have deep compassion for their grief, their fear, and their suffering. But one cannot only hold that. We cannot allow our Judaism to be manipulated into a genocide of another people.
Well, we've come to the end of our show. We'd like to thank you for listening, and we'd like to thank everyone who made our podcast possible, including United Jewish People's Order Executive Director Serena Sarin and our guests Rachel Small, Vlada Biliak, Molly Kraft, Gert Sabar, and Corinne Silverwoman. This podcast was recorded at Walt Whitman Studios in Toronto. The theme music was composed by Serena Sarin with help from me. My name is David Wall. Until next time, Zeit gesund.